Hi, welcome to our talk. We're ready to begin now. I'm Lillian Lee. My co-presenter is Jason Baldridge, and this talk was actually co-designed with Philip Resnick, who's sitting in the second row. Okay, let's get started. First thing we want to talk about is the promise of human language technologies. Speaking of which, how many of you saw the Ray Kurzweil talk yesterday? Good. Excellent. Thank you. I'm glad to know that. Next question. Why is this man smiling? If you don't recognize him, that's Alan Turing. And one reason he could be smiling, although he is actually dead, is that the year 2012, this year, marks the 100th anniversary of his birth. Now, why should you care about... Yes? Oh, sorry. Why should you care about who Alan Turing is? Well, he did quite a few things. For one thing, he's one of the founding fathers of computer science. He also happened to be one of the founding figures in artificial intelligence. So, he was not a software engineer, however. Too bad. Jason, what do we do? Okay. Right. And among... So... We're going to pause briefly. Okay. Yes. Okay, excellent. And one of the lasting ideas that Turing had is that the essence of intelligence can be demonstrated in conversation. And what do I mean by that? Well, in the following sense, that an entity can be deemed intelligent as opposed to our software. What do you think is the issue here?
It doesn't want to stay on three.
Why am I not smiling?
My guess is your hypothesis is happy with this one. Do you have it set for the right screen size?
Should be.
All right, we can take a quick poll. How many of you are willing to, we can either go with this, or we can switch laptops, which will take a little bit of your time. And no guarantee it'll work.
Do the slides.
Okay.
Thank you for your input. Okay, so right, what are we thinking about? What did we just learn? We've learned that Turing was a genius, but we already knew that. We also learned that Turing thought that basically artificial intelligence, the essence of it, can be demonstrated by conversation, in the sense that an entity can be deemed intelligent if its replies in unlimited conversation are indistinguishable from that of a human being. Okay. Now, Turing made this, posited this idea in 1950, and he actually made a bet, I don't know that he put any money on it, that we would be close to this goal in 50 years. How close are we to this? Well, these are two ads that we pulled off the interwebs. This one here, that's an ad for a system which, quote, instantly makes sense of millions of social conversations through the most advanced NLP text analytics engine on the planet. Sounds good. Okay. Beyond that, we have another ad here for the Ultra HAL Office Assistant. I'll read out to you the features here. These include that it understands English, and it learns from every sentence, and it speaks out loud, and its personality evolves, which is all really great, right? It's like AI is here. Although, I guess I'm a little disappointed to note that even though it has all these features, that thing that's in red there, what they chose to highlight is the fact that this thing also can be represented by an agent that looks like a woman in a bikini. What can we say? Still, I mean, these are products that have fairly good reviews. These exist. They're out there. So why isn't this man smiling? Anyone recognize him? Oh, I'm so old. This is Avery Brooks from an IBM ad in the year 2000 where he said, he intoned in that Avery Brooks way, "It is the year 2000, but where are the flying cars? I was promised flying cars." Okay, and why is this man not smiling? For the same reason. He said, instead of flying cars, instead what we got was 140 characters. Now, this is clearly a diss, you know, a slam on Twitter, which is, I feel, an instance of a failure to recognize the sort of miracles that Twitter and other social media systems represent. And why does this happen? I think we think there's this sort of human tendency that once a success happens, that we start to take it for granted. So, for example, you probably, because you don't know who Avery Brooks is and stuff like that, you probably won't remember, but I do, that not so long ago, there were actually conferences devoted to the huge problem that we were going to be overwhelmed with the flood of spam. That's quite the mental image, isn't it? So, but we don't want to worry about this anymore. Spam is not a problem. Right now, you have machine translation at the touch of a button, and it's hard to remember that, you know, many years ago, we thought this couldn't possibly be. You can talk to your phone, it talks back. And we have systems now that are capable of beating world human champions at Jeopardy, at answering questions in answering questions in an intelligent way. So it seems like we're already there. So, why is this man smiling? Because he thinks the future is just around the corner. All right, and I'm going to switch over to Jason now.
All right. And so one of the issues here is we agree with Ray Kurzweil on the optimism that natural language technologies and technologies and artificial intelligence are really exciting, and there's a lot of really great stuff going on. But we do want to put in a cautionary note, which is that technology can sometimes go a little funny. So there is an increasing amount of people who seem to claim that their software understands language. And for those of us who work on language, we know that this is a really hard thing to do. And it's also hard to have slides that stay up. Come on. Oh. We have lost slide connectivity. Okay. So if you search for software understands the meaning, that exact phrase, you will find many people who claim that their software understands the meaning of the text that you provide it and so on. And this is pretty common. This is just one phrase, but you'll see that this happens quite a bit, and I call hype on that. Now, there's a lot of things that go into the components of understanding, and the worry here is that we're setting expectations too high for things that are actually really great technologies, and that's a danger that we want to avoid. And one of the things to think about here are that there have been various artificial intelligence winters, one of the beginning of which was the ALPAC report, which recommended that the government not fund research into machine translation. For a while, or to dramatically reduce the funding for that. What happens is, after this disillusionment that occurs when too much hype happens, too many people are saying, we can deliver on this particular sort of solution, we can do this, we can do that, and yet they don't deliver on that. You end up with these funding cycles where people are no longer interested in funding it, whether it's government, venture capital, so on and so forth. People get disappointed. And so this relates to the hype cycle. This is frustrating that these slides are not working so well. Let's see, is there anything we can do? Lillian, can you try to bring up your computer, I guess, and stick it on one of the others? And we'll just have a few slight differences in the slides. Okay, because this is not working. Hopefully this will work just fine. So the problem with the hype cycle is, of course, that you know people get this new thing that's really exciting, and people start overblowing what they think this thing can do, and you get this huge rise of expectations, right? And then after those things don't deliver, you enter this trial of disillusionment. After that happens, reality sets in. People start to think about, okay, what can we do to actually turn the core of some particular technology, which is actually really well thought through, it's got all sorts of great work behind it, and then you get into the development cycle where you actually turn that into some kind of useful product or science. And are we... Are we leading toward this? Okay. I'll just keep trying to talk through this. It's a little bit distracting. I apologize. So... after that happens, reality sets in, and then people see how they can turn this particular... I'm going to just walk down here because it's distracting up here. Okay. All right. I'll walk over here. I don't want to get you all hearing a lot of noise there. So... after that happens, reality sets in, and people start to work on turning these technologies into something that's really useful. For example, spam detection works really well right now. It uses some fairly simple methods, but it combines the use of human annotations. Oh, there we go. Use of human annotations, reasonably simple machine learning models, lots of computing power that allows you to gather information from all these people, from all these texts, and turn it into a really useful function for approximating what is spam and what is not spam and so on. And this has really changed our lives in the sense that we don't have to deal with these massive amounts of spam in our inbox anymore. I actually used to teach spam classification in my language and computers class, but it turned out that my students didn't think it was a problem. Right? And so they were like, why are we worrying about spam? I was like, okay, it's kind of like a solved problem. That's not true when you go to Twitter nowadays and various other kinds of things. It's very hard to detect spam for new kinds of social media than it is for, say, email. But I actually switched to talking about sentiment analysis as the example for document classification in my classes, and now the students are re-engaged with that. They go, oh, that's an interesting problem. That sounds hard. And it is a hard problem. So we're still not up on that. So... one of the next slide that you're not seeing here shows you the hype cycle or sort of graph with various technologies that are still on the upward hype level, and we sort of feel like a number of those things that are currently on the hype cycle heading up are the kinds of things that get a lot of buzz at conferences like Southwest. And so they're exciting, and there is a reason to have some sense of hype because there are really cool ideas going on here, but don't overblow it, right? So that the thing to think about here is the higher this peak gets after the disillusionment, bam, you hit rock bottom. So the lower that can go. And so there's some amount of managing of expectations that needs to happen. And as people who work in the field of natural language processing, we're hoping to temper some of that a little bit while still showing you there's some really cool stuff going on in there. We are making great progress in natural language processing and not in slide delivery. We are... can I just see the next slide so I can... Yeah, excuse me, Mommy. Okay, great. Okay. I was just talking about how, as a graduate student, I had to deliver a talk on my Linux laptop, and I had to basically give half of the talk just without the slides while my laptop was rebooting, and how we don't have to worry about that anymore. So we're not on this laptop, or are we? Okay. All right. So that...
It's not clear that's working anymore.
Okay. All right. Can you throw your slides onto a PDF, throw it onto this laptop, and then we'll do it from PDF? Okay. So we're just going to move right on by there. Lillian, you're actually up now, so why don't you go ahead and talk a bit about that.
What we're going to talk about now is the notion of, why are all these... why don't we have these technologies yet? And we often get the response from maybe half the populace that it must be because you guys are stupid. And you guys must be stupid because my 5-year-old can understand language and respond, right? If I take a child and I ask her the question, what's a difficult choice that you faced? You can imagine the child can actually respond, you know, something like clean my room or listen to my mother sing my least favorite song over and over.
Okay.
Right? If you ask a baby this, ones that are verbal, they can still respond. They might say something like, bath or pink dress, I hate both those alternatives, right? They don't say the last part, but they have that meaning there. They're able to generate the notion, even if they can't generate precisely grammatical language. However, if you think about science fiction sort of representations, they're already aware that there's some sort of problem. If you ask RTD2, hey, what's the hardest problem, RT, you've ever faced? What does he say? beep. Right? Either he didn't understand, or even if he understands, he cannot generate language, right? In some sense, science fiction has already told us that this is a hard problem. Yes?
You have
awesome. Oh. All right. So, somewhere there's a clicker. Can I even do this? Yes. Okay. So let me give you an example of why language is hard to understand, even though children should do it. So if nothing else, you should go away from this talk feeling, wow, that five-year-old's really smart. Okay. Here's a classic example. I saw her duck with a telescope. Let's imagine that this is being said in a scenario where a woman is ducking because apparently there are potatoes flying around. Okay. In that case, what this sentence can be analyzed is that the word duck means the verb to duck, like this. Okay, in which case you can ask, if that's true, who has the telescope? Okay, so it could be that she is ducking while holding a telescope, or it could be that I am seeing her do the ducking while I hold the telescope, right? So what we have here, what this prepositional phrase modifies is ambiguous. So we have an example of prepositional phrase attachment ambiguity. Now, that's not the only possible scenario that this sentence might refer to. Maybe there's a duck sitting there. Instead, therefore, in this kind of setting, you might imagine that therefore the word duck is a noun in this case, meaning this duck, this animal that quacks that's sitting there. Now, in that case, it's possible that the duck has the telescope, right? It's kind of got it tucked under its wing. Okay, or it could be I am seeing that duck with a telescope. But notice it cannot be that she has the telescope, right? Give me a nod. Right. So there's something interesting here, right? It implies that there's some sort of hidden complex structure because not all combinatorial possibilities are listed. Okay? So what we have here is, so we've seen an example of the prepositional phrase attachment ambiguity. We see an example of part of speech ambiguity. But you can have even deeper ambiguity with a single word, even if the part of speech of that word is fixed. Let's take the word saw. Okay, it's a verb in this sense. It could mean that I saw her with my eyes, right? Or you can think of the grimmer, gorier interpretation. I saw her duck with a telescope. Ah, come on. There we go. All right, and here's another interpretation I've heard fairly recently. Imagine it's the zombie apocalypse has happened and we're all playing poker, and so we're now in a barter economy. Yeah, right? So that's also possible. Less likely because, for instance, the zombie apocalypse hasn't happened yet. But all the same, these are other meanings that this sentence can possibly have. So this kind of complexity is enough to make us clutch our heads, which is what that animation, never ever back up, right? Always sally forth, no matter what. I'm clutching my head because this ambiguity is flying about me. Okay, here's an example that shows that even words that you would think have a totally single fixed meaning can still be ambiguous. So ambiguity is pervasive. If you saw this phrase, which is, I believe, due to Steve Abney, the AR of I, it looks like word salad, right? This doesn't mean anything. Well, it turns out it is possible to assign a meaning to this. Imagine we're in a setting of verdant rolling hills, okay? And it's divided up into these 100-meter square air units, which are apparently called airs, okay? So there's an air. There's an air. Here's the ith column of airs. And here's the eighth R of that ith column, the AR of I. Totally meaningful, right? So again, there's an ambiguity in these words here that you would have thought have only one meaning. Okay. So these are the kind of challenges that we run into when we try to get a system to understand natural language. The problem is there are so many possible meanings allowed, and that may have to be accounted for once the zombie apocalypse happens, right? Okay. And let's remember that we are not living in a single language world, right? If we want to build systems that are going to be practical, they have to be able to deal with the fact that there are many other languages out there besides English. Anyone speak Chinese? More importantly, read Chinese? You can get a little laugh there. The rest of you will have to type this into Google Translate to find out. Okay. So, in summary, you know, This is a famous phrase from science fiction. A computer says to someone, "I'm sorry, Dave, I'm afraid I can't do that." And that's meant to be sinister if you've seen the film or, you know. However, we as natural language processing scientists know that because language processing is so hard, we are tempted to respond, "I'm afraid you might be right." Do you want the clicker? Or
sure.
Okay.
And that nicely shows two ambiguities, at least, of the word afraid, right? One as in being polite, "I'm afraid I can't help you with that." And the other one as, "I'm really afraid, I'm scared." Right? So it has you right in there. Now, one of the things that's made a huge change in natural language processing has been sort of two big things. One are data-driven approaches, so we're using a lot of data to estimate interesting things about language. And we have really interesting models of language. So let's look a little bit at that. The field of natural language processing has had a sea change since the late 80s of bringing in statistical methods into all of the stuff that we do. So the this natural language understanding book is actually the book that I learned in my first computational linguistics class. No statistics in this book whatsoever. It's all deep knowledge approaches, syntax, semantics, that sort of thing. And then in the early 90s, we start seeing books coming up that are bringing statistical methods into sort of the core realm of computational linguistics. In the middle, you see The Balancing Act, which Philip helped edit, which really brought together a whole bunch of researchers who were exploring the potential for statistical methods in natural language processing. And now the two core textbooks in the field are statistical through and through, although Jurafsky and Martin, the main one, has a very nice mix of both statistical and deep natural language processing methodologies. What's really cool here is Stanford is now bringing out these very well-known courses that are open to the public. One of these is a natural language processing course, which has just started up recently, and there are 30,000 people who've signed up for it. And that's really exciting. That really says something about what the field is bringing to sort of the everyday world and what people see as being really valuable about the field. And so that's one of the things we want to really stress here is all the progress that has been made such that people are finding it really useful. Okay? What has made a big difference? Well, one thing is that text is pervasive. When I started working in computational linguistics, we had small corpora, we had sometimes toy examples that we'd work with. Now, throughout the 2000s, more and more text has become more and more a part of our field. And it's coming all over the place. We have books that are being digitized, we've got online newspapers, tweets, all of this sort of stuff. It's really exciting in terms of opening up our field to be able to ask many questions that we couldn't ask before. We can also learn models that we could never learn before, right? So we have this really interesting interaction of that kind of text with metadata. And the metadata is stuff that is sometimes being created by people who are explicitly marking out things like, when did Bill Gates, when was he born, what does he do, various other bits of information about him and so on. That's sort of semi-structured, but on the fairly highly structured form of annotated data, right, that goes along with a bunch of text on the Wikipedia page for Bill Gates that tells you in unstructured form, just text form, other things about Bill Gates. So we can start to learn the mapping between that unstructured text and things like infoboxes. Similarly, people like to rate movies. That means that they have just associated some bit of text, their little bit of review, with some object, a movie, and with a star rating from 1 to 5. We can start to learn very interesting things about people's preferences for movies and what people use to express liking and disliking in language. Right, because this is metadata that we can use to pin, sort of to pivot on in understanding language better. Obviously, there's other things like liking, spam filtering, and so on. Another thing that's, I think, really exciting is the fact that we have devices that are capturing metadata about our interactions in the world. So Flickr, for example, many cameras, phones have geotagged photographs, and people write little bits about the photograph that they've taken. This is going to allow us to start associating language with geography, and I'll talk more about that a little later on. There's other forms of annotation, such as lists of names of cities and states and countries. We can learn interesting things from that. The census, we can learn what are male names, female names, etc. This is going to also allow us to estimate certain kinds of social variables. Okay. And in combination with that, we have a lot of progress on machine learning, and learning with structure. So you can think about one of the sort of core goals of machine learning over many, many years is to do things like unsupervised discovery of knowledge from some collection of text, for example. So text clustering, that's something that is actually coming up in applications these days, where you can basically feed in, you turn your text into a bunch of numbers, we feed it to an algorithm, and the algorithm can identify, well, these look like these are texts that go together, these are texts that go together. And when you're presenting, say, some set of search results to a person, you can show a prototypical example of a cluster rather than bombarding you with tons and tons of text, right? So those are getting actually more and more sophisticated. On the right, you're seeing what's called a plate diagram for something that's called a dynamic topic model. This is a really interesting kind of model that looks at what are sort of, it discovers, in a sense, semantic concepts, in a loose sense, I say that, semantic concepts, and looks at how they track over time. The point is not to describe this model in detail. The point is to show you there's structure to the model. And you can think about, look at this as if you're looking up from the top of a mastaba or a pyramid, looking down where you see the sort of core, the smallest rectangles as sort of the highest level of the pyramid, and you're looking down into it, and there's structure down below. And the little blacked out or grayed out dots, those are words or documents that we're observing. So we go from the observed level and you dig deeper in as you go in, all right? And so we're learning that there's structure behind these things. Now, that still does has a lot of assumption in it, which, for example, we call the bag of words assumption, all right? This means that in a model like this, we don't treat, the man bit the dog or the dog bit the man as any different, yet we know that one is news and the other one isn't. And so one of the really exciting things is that just in the last few years, the models and methods that we're using are starting to get to the point where we are able to deal with structured representations of meaning. What you're seeing here is actually an example of a semantic and syntactic analysis of the language Haida. This is very detailed, non-statistical, but the models and methods that people are creating are now getting towards a point where we can start thinking about learning these kinds of very deep representations from text and perhaps a small amount of annotated data. All right. So this is really exciting. When people talk about understanding language and that their software understands language, trust me, they're not doing this. They might be doing the topic models. That is not language understanding. Even if you can do this, this is not language understanding. And that's going to get into the second part of our talk where we're talking about grounding in language. As long as all you're doing is turning language into a bunch of symbols, right, characters on a page, into a bunch of other symbols, you are not understanding language. You got to be careful about saying that. Okay. So this sort of looking at language as, or the processing of language as something where we can take a lot of data, we can take these pretty models, I'll say, and then we need to do something useful with them. And so there's a theoretical advance, I think, on the side of being able to represent language in a really interesting way and learn those structures. And then there's, well, let's build Watson. And when you do that, you need to have some kind of architecture that will deal with grabbing the data that you need, dealing with uncertainty. You know, if you're doing a question answering system that is basically what Watson is, you need to have various databases ready for you, some scoring methods, et cetera. You kind of get into something of a Rube Goldberg machine. But underlying all this are various components that are theoretically motivated and interesting. Okay, so that's kind of a key thing there. But turning this into a real application takes a lot of work and kind of going away from the theoretical beauty. So an example of something that needs to happen in a system such as Watson are things like paraphrase learning, right? So if you just have a question, is Snooki on Stork Watch, right? You put that into Google, and what you get back are 8 results that all come from a while ago when Snooki was not on Stork Watch. So what does that mean? You know, some of you might be like, okay, most people in this room can probably figure that out by now, right? Even if you don't know who Snooki is, you can probably figure out, well, that's probably a woman who is pregnant. And, well, how can we figure this out with text classification methods and text exploration methods? Well, you can go out and start searching for those terms, get a bunch of documents. And so you'd like to be able to return as an answer to that Snooki and her fiancé are expecting their first child together. Well, we can learn that expecting a child and Stork Watch are related or concepts or paraphrases of one another by grabbing a whole bunch of text, looking for who is the subject of this predicate, what is the predicate itself,
looking for a whole bunch of examples of these and situations where we find those two things co-occurring in the same document. And if you find that there's evidence for that across many different documents, you can learn that Storkwash is a paraphrase of expecting a child. And this doesn't involve deep natural language understanding. You might use syntactic analysis to do this, right? And that might make your model better. That doesn't mean you're doing any understanding, but it's a really strong, good technology. And it's actually work that Lillian did a while ago. So, and of course, we want to be careful, this whole thing of having multiple lines of evidence that tell us that the paraphrase of Storkwatch is expecting a child, that's why we need this to make sure we don't think that Snooki might be an assistant district attorney, which is not likely given her profile. Okay? All right, so.
All right, so now we'd like to devote some amount of time to talking about where we are headed, us personally and also the field. So here's some recent work. I think the general theme of where we're headed is more, as Jason has already hinted at, having natural language systems more interact with the world and more understand what's going on in the world. Some of the most important stuff that's going on in the world, of course, is people and what they're up to, which is one of the reasons social media has really made natural language processing become a very exciting and relevant technology today. What this graph is an analysis of the news. Okay. This was a study where the researchers behind the study were looking for memes and how they occur, how they spike, how they get carried along, what phrases are sticky. So this is a plot of roughly 2 or 3 months of news, and each of these spikes corresponds to an automatically discovered meme, such as this red one here is the meme, lipstick on a pig, where a meme is represented as a phrase in direct quotes. Okay, so you can see that the phrase lipstick on a pig really spiked around September 12th, which is roughly when Obama uttered these words, and it continued on in the press. What this is mentions in the press as gathered from a really large spinner crawl of Newswire's blog mentions and the like. Okay, so you can see that in general things may spike. They get really hot for a while. Everyone was talking about lipstick on a pig, but eventually it fades out of the sort of collective consciousness. And you can see this pattern happening with other phrases. This is I'll get my country moving again. This is our entire economy is in danger. Okay, spiky, but not very sticky. All right. So this is interesting because it actually, well, first of all, just because it's interesting, why do things stick and why do some things fade away? Another thing that the researchers found is they're able to tell one something about the news cycle itself, which is something we think of as a human phenomenon. And they were able to find something about this human phenomenon that wasn't really known before. This little heartbeat here, that's an interpolation of the gray data, is the number of mentions of a particular meme in the press, popular press, versus in blogs. Okay, so do I have that backwards? Right, so this heartbeat here means that it should be the fraction of, yeah, right, okay, good. So low means it's more happening. I have this backwards.
High is in the blog, low is in the
fraction
news,
of blog
mentions.
It goes the other way, up, down, you know. Okay, so up means that the blogs are talking about something more. Down means that the popular press is talking about something more. So what we see here is that relative to the peak time when a meme gets mentioned, when it hits that spike, who's talking about that meme? Beforehand, it's the blogs. Only later does the popular media catch up. Okay, and then later after the popular media catches up, then it drops out of the popular media and it's back to the blogs again. Okay, so we have this heartbeat shape, which hadn't been observed before, and you can imagine that this was of interest to people who wonder, where does our news come from? Where do memes come from? Do they come from the popular press and then they're adopted by the blogs? Or do the bloggers discover this stuff first and then the popular media catches on? Okay, and you can draw your own conclusions from there. Sorry? Okay, I heard a little rustle from the crowd. I'm not sure what that meant. possibly a blogger. Okay, now I want to also talk about sort of a project related to the meme tracker idea. In the meme tracker original project, what counted as a meme was a direct quote. Okay, and so you saw whether this direct quote appeared in later press or, you know, like that, or was propagated. You can ask the question about whether you can look at more complicated forms of memes. Can we recognize changes in memes and the like? Or you can ask the question, what is it about those phrases that made them stick? Obama said lipstick on a pig. If I had said something about lipstick on a pig, would it have gone viral? Sadly, probably not, right? So that makes it seem like it's not the phrase itself, right? It's who said it. And yet there is something very catchy about the phrase lipstick on a pig, right? There's something striking about it. It seems like if Obama said lipstick on a pig, he actually, does anyone remember what he said after that? He had what I actually think is a more striking image. He said, you can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig. You can wrap a fish in old newspaper, but it's still a fish. And it stinks after a while. Something like that, I'm paraphrasing, I can't remember, right? I find that an actually more striking image, but nobody remembers that, right? Lipstick on a pig, stuck. Fish in newspaper, didn't stick. Is there something about the phrasing there that make you think maybe we could know that one of those was going to stick and one of them was going to pass out of the cultural memory immediately? So why is this man smiling? You presumably, this is a scene from The Shining. What is he saying? Here's Johnny. How many people knew that? That's in the popular culture, right? We remember it. If he had said, brah, would you remember that? Probably not. He may, in fact, have said that, but we don't remember that. We do remember he said, here's Johnny. Okay, but is there anything particularly special about the phrase, here's Johnny? That's a question you might ask. And in some recent research, we have found that, yes, of course it matters who the actor is who's saying it, whether the movie struck a chord with people and like that, but independent of these situational and contextual effects, there are phrasing effects that affect the memorability of a phrase. And in particular, one of our findings is that, in fact, memorable movie quotes in aggregate, you guys will all go, I know this movie quote and it defies your theory. I'm talking about a general aggregate kind of thing here, is that they tend to have unusual word choices. So the words themselves are unusual, but the syntactic structure of the sentence is actually not unusual at all. Okay, and these are results that are come upon by language modeling techniques, which we didn't have time to talk about. Also, so the way we tested this is by using the IMDb memorable quotes. You can tell whether a quote is memorable by whether it got listed in IMDb or not. And these results actually carry over in an interesting sense I can't get into now to ad slogans. So you can picture the possible applications. Again, we can't really predict maybe for an individual phrase whether it's going to stick or not. But in aggregate, we can characterize some, we can come up with some characterizations of what makes a phrase memorable. Okay. Next, I want to talk about Twitter. Twitter's big. It's Austin, South by Southwest, and all that. This is some work that both Jason has worked on and I have worked on independently, as well as other people, of course, which is trying to determine the sentiment of tweets in order to determine sort of a more general notion of what is the nation thinking. Okay, or at least Twitter nation. Is that a phrase? All right. So here's an example. Here's this green box here represents a Twitterer, a tweeter. I'm sorry, I don't know the terms of art here. And they are saying, Obama is making the Repubs look silly and petty. This is an actual tweet. And you can ask the question, what is the sentiment of that tweeter toward Obama? And we as human beings know this is positive toward Obama. So by the sentiment here, I'm using a very rough notion of, is someone pro or con a particular topic? What is R2-D2 here, I think? Well, we have sentiment analysis algorithms, but this would be a pretty hard one to get for a sentiment automated sentiment analysis algorithm. In the following sense, our system might say, I see the words Obama, I see the word silly, and I see the word petty. Okay, and silly and petty are negative words. So a system might well conclude, wrongly, that our Twitter is a red state right-leaning bird. Okay? So negative toward Obama. However, and this gets toward the theme of natural language kind of reaching out toward the world, if we look at sort of the social setting in which this tweeter is situated, suppose he or she is following these other Twitter users, okay, and they're all mutually following each other, just for argument's sake. And this one tweets, is happy Obama is president, and this one tweets, Obama's doing great. Those are ones our sentiment, an automated sentiment analysis algorithm might be very easy, might find very easy to classify and also be able to classify them with high confidence. Okay, so putting together that information that this person maybe, it looks to the system like from the words that they are negative toward Obama, but they're connected to people who it's, the system is quite sure are positive toward Obama. With any luck, it can combine all that information together in various sophisticated and kind of cool algorithmic ways to determine that, in fact, this person is actually a blue state left-leaning bird, that they are positive toward Obama. Okay, so this notion of using the idea of social interactions together with the language, we both think is going to be very powerful and clearly applies in our social media saturated world. Okay, one final thing here until I pass the baton to Jason. In social media, the point is interaction, right? So interaction is something that's been studied an awful lot. One particular aspect of interaction that I want to focus on for this slide is the notion of coordination. So Kate Niederhofer, who's sitting right here and laughing, hopefully she's happy. Are you by any chance? I'm not worthy. Jamie Pennebaker and Kate Niederhofer, folks, they're in the house. I feel like I should just give them the mic. I'm just flabbergasted. Thank you for coming. They're famous, as you can tell from the fact that I'm actually blushing now. And they work on, their work on language coordination was an inspiration for the work I'm going to describe here. They said something very nice. Communicative behaviors are patterning coordinated, like a dance. The particular paper where they said that, they were talking about language coordination, but I want to talk a little bit about the metaphor of dance. Okay, so if you have two partners, when they are dancing and it's going well, when they're coordinating, this doesn't mean that overall, if Travolta does this, then overall Uma Thurman does this, right? It means more that there's an immediate reaction, okay? One person has the lead, the other person reacts immediately, and they may not directly echo what the other person has said, but they immediately respond in some way that matches. Okay, so taking that metaphor to the language level, we can ask, okay, if we just looked at the language of conversational interactants, and we didn't look at the topic of what they were saying, but just sort of the style of it, could we determine who has the lead at a particular point in time? Okay, so this is supposed to be a little conversation between these two, and what I've done is blocked out the content words and said, let's suppose we just concentrate on the functional words here. So I've color-coded these two. The blue things mean prepositions and the red things mean articles. So suppose you saw that every time, so when Uma says something with an article, with a preposition and an article, Travolta immediately responds with something that contains a preposition and an article. Okay, and when Uma says this with this pattern, Travolta responds with a similar pattern. When she does this, same thing here. The colors are matching. Okay, you might well infer that the character on the left has the lead at that particular point in time. Okay, so what we actually find, and we did this with Wikipedia admins versus non-admins and Supreme Court justices versus lawyers, is that people with less power do intend to immediately match, and by match we mean sort of echo but not necessarily repeat, the function word choices. So this is very subtle, unconscious sort of thing going on. The people with less power tend to immediately match the function word choices of those with less power. Okay. And we think that's interesting because there's this sort of immediate sort of reaction to other people. It also has some interesting implications possibly for releasing social media data. It says that we can learn things about the participants even if you scrub out the content part and just give us the content words. So maybe we can get redacted versions of all that data that's available. Okay, I think I'm going to turn it over to you now.
Great. So remember back to the meme tracker example of where something deeper about the cycle of news in terms of blog and mainstream media was shown by a model that looked at lots of data and then looked at some aggregate statistics on that. Here's another example of finding those kinds of patterns by using a model. In this case, it's using a topic model. This is work by Philip, who's right here. Looking at debates from the last presidential elections, you can run a topic model on this that looks at what are the basic semantic concepts that each turn of one of the debaters is using. So they're talking about certain kinds of concepts, in one case, and then the moderator will move on with another question, and so on. And what you can do is use these topic models to see when one of the debaters diverges from what was previously being done. So in other words, they're sort of taking control of the discourse. What's cool about this is you can do this and look for these particular cases where something shows up as, whoa, the person just shifted what they were talking about. Somebody was talking about something, and the person shifted the whole topic into something else. And then the model is highlighting this, right? So this is just based on the word statistics, what the text was, and the model says, bam, right there. And then when you look at it, this is actually an example of Palin not answering the question. And you know, we can read into that if you like. But basically says, you know, that's a fine question, but I've got a different thing I want to talk about. And then goes on and shifts the thing. So now you could perhaps start thinking about, well, how much are different people in a conversation taking control of the conversation? How much are they relinquishing control? And so there's a lot more detail on that that if anybody's curious, Philip can answer a lot in detail. He's now looking at spin and how different people are messaging consistently, say, in different political parties. One of the things that motivates me in my research nowadays is getting at the question of what does a word mean. And so in computational linguistics, we need to have a way of formally representing a word and what it means. Now, one of the things that we've generally done is we take a bag of words and we represent a word as a bag of words. Anybody have an idea of what word might be represented by this word cloud? Barbecue, exactly. So this is a representation of barbecue. In most models of word meaning, what we do is we look at a bunch of text, we find the word barbecue, we look at the words that surround it, we count them up, and then we have a frequency distribution over those words. That actually can do allow us to do a lot of interesting things, such as looking at whether barbecue is similar to cow or beach or whatever. The thing about that, though, is that we're representing words in terms of words. So there's a circularity. Now, when you look up a definition in the dictionary, you know what the words mean. You just don't know what that particular word you're looking up means, but then it's described in terms of words that you have grounded representations for, right? In the case of these machine learned models that are just looking at text, they don't know what these words mean. They just know that cooking is some statistic that's associated with the word barbecue. So Katrin, Eric, and I, we're both in the linguistics department at the University of Texas, are looking into, well, can we start getting richer models of word meaning? So, for example, can the word barbecue be represented as some sort of distribution over images that contain barbecue in them, right, or barbecue events? Can we look at the temporal aspect of barbecue and look at how many times were people having barbecue over the years from, you know, 2000 BC up to the current day? Does barbecue have an interesting distribution that way? Think chariot, for example. Chariots were not, they were used a lot back in the Roman Empire, not so much today. I'll give you some examples of modern day things as well. The other thing is distribution over the world, and this is the main focus of my research, is looking at a geographic grounding of words, and I'll give you some examples of that in a moment. What we really want is to get at what's in that kid's head when he's experiencing the joy of barbecue, hopefully here somewhere near Austin. And so we don't know how to get there. I have friends who work on robotics, and it's a really hard problem. When you want to have a robot running around, learning what a table is, bumping into things, that's a very hard knowledge representation problem. What we want to do is be able to work with all the text that's been brought to us. You know, everybody who's out there tweeting right now or talking about the barbecue that they had last night and so on, they're giving us data that has points connected to the real world and tied to text. And we want to be able to exploit that to do interesting things with language. And what we'll see is it's not just evil stuff. So keep your eye on there. So let's think about what the meaning of a word is with respect to geography. So for example, I'm going to show you four different words and their geographic representation over the world. All right, over the United States in this particular case. These actually do go over the entire world. This is drawn from Wikipedia. What you're seeing is high bars there are indications that a word is very associated with a particular location. Can anybody guess what that word might be? Beach, yep. Okay, how about this one? Mountain. So this is just learned from the geotags that are associated with pages in Wikipedia, and you end up with these really interesting things that conform to your expectations, right, about where beaches and mountains occur. Now, how about this one? This is a little bit harder. This is not a geographic feature. This is something that you consume. And a little hint, those big bars over there are France and Spain. Wine, yep. Okay, here's another one. Something else you consume. Barbecue, yep. So this is barbecue, back to barbecue. Now, one of the cool things about this is when you do this with these models, they can become a data exploration device. And when you look around the other side of the world, you discover that there's a huge bar over the Philippines. And that happens to be the Cebuano province of the Philippines. And I was like, wow, why? I was just looking at this on Google Earth, and I said, why is there this huge spike? And then I looked it up, and it turns out that for the Cebuano people, barbecue is not just food, it's the culture. And there's all this stuff about how passionate the Cebuano people are about culture. This relates to what my colleague Matt Cohen, who's in the English department, is really interested in. People who work in English these days, they want to be able to work with large amounts of text and discover interesting things. You know, he's interested in Walt Whitman, so he wants to be able to discover interesting things about Walt Whitman that he would not be able to discover by reading reams and reams of text, maybe even the stuff not that Walt Whitman wrote, but that were related to the time that Walt Whitman was writing. So he'd like to be able to have these models as ways of doing hypothesis discovery, to discover what are potentially interesting questions in a large body of text. So that's an example of that. You can also look at Twitter and see what is going on with dialectal variation. And so this is an example of distributions for cool, 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 and cool. All right, over the United States, based on what people are tweeting. And so what you'll see is that for certain variations on the form cool, there are spikes in certain areas and spikes in other areas for others. And we can use these to do a task called geolocation. So this means I can train a model over the world, or you know, over a restricted area of the Earth, using geotagged tweets. What you're seeing are these tweets down here are ones that would have a geotag associated with them. Thank you to all of you who turn on your geotag tweets. I don't do that because I'm not sure about that whole thing. But I'm happy to use them. And what we can do is create essentially word distributions over the Earth's surface. And once you've done that, you give me a new tweet or set of tweets, and I'm going to calculate how similar that tweet is to all of those little language models I built over the entire Earth's surface. Based on that, I can pick some function on that, maybe the maximum one or some region of high density of similarity, and then I can predict that that's where that person is. So we're still far from pinpointing a person. You know, we are with Wikipedia pages, we can do this to like within 20 miles generally for a Wikipedia page. So you give me the Wikipedia page for the University of Texas at Austin Tower, bam, we're pretty close to that. For Twitter users, we're about 450 kilometers off. So, you know, like Houston to Austin kind of range. That's still useful if you have a whole bunch of unannotated, non-geotag tweets. You can start looking at the distribution of what people are saying over state level, for example, or even city level. All right, and we're improving these models right now. We're taking in a lot more data, and the more data you have, the better these things work, basically. Okay. I don't wish to use these for evil. My goal is to actually help with conflicts, right? Because you can start thinking immediately about the kinds of things that this would not be great for. But one of the projects I'm working on is working with a collection of genocide transcripts from the Rwandan genocide. And the people who are collecting these transcripts would like to be able to take, these are translated in English, French, and Kinyarwanda. They'd like to be able to see that there's a name like Kichikuru in there, map it into Google Earth, and now we would be able to essentially have that document embedded automatically into Google Earth. And now you can contextualize it with respect to other places that you might know, like Hotel Rwanda. And so now this person's discourse is imbued with greater meaning because now you can contextualize it in terms of space and perhaps even time. All right? We just got a data set from Ushahidi that we're really excited to work on and see if we can improve things for them. Now, it's not just geo. We can also think about temporality. So look at, this is not our work, but some other folks, Alessandro Moschetti, looking at what are the words people are using most frequently over during the course of the day. And so if you look at things like breakfast, lunch, and dinner, no surprises, right? This is exactly the kind of thing like a mountain or a beach. However, okay, we can also look at things like Kanye West and Justin Bieber, and you can see that Bieber is getting tweeted an awful lot during the sort of early evening hours, and by about 10 o'clock, the kids are going to bed, Kanye West fans are picking up. That tells us something about what Kanye and Bieber mean in the public, right? Okay, you can also look at it by day. So no surprise that over the course of a year, and this is from Google Trends, which many people will be familiar with, you can have things like snow and beach, and they have characteristic patterns in terms of winter and summer. But you can also have things like cookie and diet, where cookie spikes right around Christmas, and then right after that, people go into diet mode, right? That tells us something about people's actions in the real world. It connects the language to the real world, which is the whole point here. And people have brought the real world to us by doing things like searching for cookies and diets in Google. Okay, you can also look at gender, right? If you do a rough matching of people's Twitter handles to male and female, you can look at what is the ratio of word choice between men and women. And so these are just some examples of things. Men seem to be more obsessed with death, women with baby, and men with sport, and so on. That tells us, again, something about a social variable that might be of interest in various kinds of prediction tasks. So here's where the public service announcement comes in. These methods that we're using in computational linguistics are prone to having errors, right? There is the potential for not understanding the language correctly. And this goes back to my point about look for your wallet when people say they understand the text, the meaning of the text. This is an application called HealthBase by a company, NetBase, that has a lot of really great computational linguistics in it. They did a lot of work in there, but there was a problem with word sense disambiguation where they learned that Jews caused AIDS, right? This is an application that tells you something about the causes and treatments for various kinds of medical ailments. So, in other words, the domain was expanded well beyond that of health, and the model just didn't know how to deal with that. And so this led to what was referred to as the anti-Semitic search engine. And there are other little things that happen in there. There's another problem in that it learned that vaccines cause autism, which is not supported by any scientific evidence, but which is a common theme that many people shout about on the internet, and the sources that it used would take that in and learn that. Now, there's problems with these technologies getting things right as well, and the obvious thing here is privacy, right? As we talk about geolocating people and things like that, that's a real issue. So things are coming out, and this is not necessarily text to start with, but things like a gay teenager being discovered by his father that he's gay because of the ads that are coming up on his Facebook stream. A teenage daughter being discovered that she's pregnant by her father because Target is sending her ads for various pregnancy-related products to their house. Also, Netflix had its Netflix Prize, which people know about. Something that a lot of people don't know about is that a team here at UT Austin de-anonymized the Netflix Prize. So Netflix posted all of these movie preferences, right, as a task for anybody around the world to work on. The team here at UT said, let's take those movie preferences, look at things like IMDb, and see if we can match people up. And they show that they can. In other words, companies are putting out your data thinking that it's anonymized, and it's not. So how does this then come back around? Well, now if you have text in somebody's Facebook page, you might be able to associate them to things like whether they're gay, whether they're pregnant, whether they have certain movie preferences. And you don't know if you want people to know your movie preferences. There's things like ratings that people do online. We can start associating the things that you have written in reviews on Yelp to these other kinds of variables. However, something to even be more careful about is the same basic techniques that were used to de-anonymize Netflix are being used to do internet-scale authorship identification. So you have your anonymous comment somewhere on Amazon or some other review site. Maybe we can start figuring out who you might be, even though you didn't put your name on there. And now we can start mapping you back to those other kinds of things we might want to predict. So beware that privacy is a real issue, and these technologies are in some ways more powerful and more capable than you'd think. Okay. And we had a slide about humans make things wrong too, and the whole thing of onion fails and people misunderstand, but that didn't make it into this slide. So
just quickly to wrap up, we want to say so that we don't think the future is quite here yet, but we think there's a lot of potential possibilities, and we think we've moved forward fairly well. Things are actually moving fast right now, in part because of advances in learning, in scalability, both in the amount of data we can deal with and the amount of computation we can employ, and in depth of representation. And one example that's going to come up, if you're interested in this thing, Philip is giving a panel at 12:30 at the AT&T Conference Center on natural language processing techniques applied to electronic health records, which is obviously a very important domain. Do I have to give any other information? 12:30 at the AT&T room 204, I believe. Finally, concluding slide, why is this man smiling? It's not actually a smile of triumph, right? That's sort of an enigmatic smile, because he didn't think we'd actually accomplished it. He was hoping that we could get to this goal. He said, I don't actually know what we should do, but I think different approaches should be tried. And then this last thing I'm going to pull up is how he actually concluded his essay, this inspirational Turing test introducing essay. I find it just a very striking thing to say. We can only see a short distance ahead, but we can see plenty there that needs to be done. His last words, our last words, thank you.
So, questions?
There's a mic if you want to take questions or ask questions. I'm nervous.
Hi, my name is Kathy Halley. I run the digital programs for a nonprofit that's called the Poetry Foundation. And I'm just wondering if you all know of people that are using natural language processing and these kinds of things on poems themselves, because we've been trying to think about doing a poem recommendation engine, and if anybody is working on that, we would love to hear from them. So it's
yeah, actually, there's a recent paper from Google. There's a recent paper from Google on doing machine translation for poetry. And if you give me information, I can give you the link to that. And there is a whole computational stylistics and poetry track. It's a small one, but an interesting one in computational linguistics.
Yeah. There's also been some work on, I don't know if you know, the extremely constrained form of Chinese quatrains. There's this incredibly complex, and there has these, and there's actually been some work on generating those by Microsoft. We should say that we're going to post our slides online. I guess if we could get the first thing so that people could see what it is. So if you have questions, also you can find our slides online, and we can post more information at those sites too if you have further questions for us.
Can you fast forward 5 or 10 years? As far as I'm concerned, this thing called Siri doesn't really do much for me. Mm-hmm. Are the improvements going to come from better algorithms or just better raw processing power?
Better what?
Better algorithms or better raw processing power?
So better algorithms or better processing, you said?
Better raw processing speed.
One of the things to realize about Siri is that was rolled out early because what it's doing right now is collecting data.
Right.
And that data is in part the main components that is needed to start improving the results that it has. So essentially, it's in beta, and we're all helping train the machine. Now, of course, Siri only goes so far in terms of being able to understand what's going on. I mean, according to my whole point that I was making earlier. So it's going to be limited in terms of understanding how to switch from one domain to the other. It might be really good at restaurants, but terrible if you start talking about more esoteric things, I don't know, certain kinds of music and whatnot. So there's still this problem of bootstrapping from a lot of sources online and recognizing as well that you want to talk about a particular thing, right? So the goal I think that they had pushing that out was collect more data so at least we can do a lot of the common things well. But even that, it's a hard problem. I mean, I was still surprised, and I've only recently started to use Siri, and I use it very limitedly. But it's exciting that that technology has been brought to the point where it's in the hands of people. So,
I guess I would say that it isn't just more data, and Jason doesn't think it's just more data either. It's when you have more data, it does allow us to build more sophisticated algorithms, mm-hmm. and it allows us to see more phenomena and be more cross domain. So I think. I'll let Jason speak for himself, but I don't think it's just data. We need the data, but also more sophisticated algorithms are going to come from the insights we get from that more data.
Yeah, absolutely. Any questions?
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.